we're not only endangering Palestinians, but we're also very much, I think, endangering Israeli and other Jews, because I believe that ultimately the safety of Israeli Jews and the safety of Palestinians is intimately interconnected. It is just utterly foolish, it seems to me, to believe that you can inflict terrible, terrible, catastrophic violence on people again and again and again and not be endangering yourselves. To me, that is one of the lessons of October 7th. That is not to justify October 7th, it's simply to say that, the way you act to others is also likely to influence the way other people act to you. It's the most basic of human reality.
That's Peter Beinart, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Peter Beinart on protest, Zionism, and Gaza. On December 5th, Amnesty International determined that it has found sufficient basis to conclude that the government of Israel has committed and is continuing to commit genocide against Palestinians in the occupied Gaza Strip. In the landmark report, You Feel Like You Are Subhuman, Israel's Genocide Against Palestinians in Gaza, Amnesty International documents how, during its military offensive launched in the wake of the deadly Hamas-led attacks in southern Israel on October 7, 2023, Israeli forces have carried out acts prohibited under the Genocide Convention, with the specific intent to destroy Palestinians in Gaza, unquote. The report goes on to say, quote, by continuing to supply weapons to the Israeli government, the U.S. government is violating its obligation to prevent and punish genocide and is at serious risk of becoming complicit in genocide. Our guest today is Peter Beinart. He's professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York. He's a contributing opinion editor at the New York Times, and he's editor-at-large of Jewish Currents. He's the author of The Crisis of Zionism and Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza. Peter Beinart spoke at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in mid-November. The moderator, Michelle Mushabek, begins.
I would like to hear your thoughts about the student and pro-Palestine solidarity movements. And as the U.S. continues its unqualified support for Israel, how do we assess the success of these movements?
I guess I just wanted to start by saying that I feel like when I speak on this subject, it's important for me to acknowledge that I know that there are going to be people in this room and maybe people who are listening and not in this room who are going to disagree with certain things that I say. And when I see that there are people in an audience who disagree with me from whatever perspective, I always feel a deep sense of gratitude that they've come to listen, because I think one of the things that so often happens on this subject and other subjects is people only go to listen to those that they agree with. One of my favorite quotes from Jewish texts is from Pirkei Avot, "Who is wise? The one who learns from all people." So I always feel like if you have gone for a long distance to try to learn from someone that you actually are inclined to disagree with, you are kind of showing a wisdom that actually is a model for all of us, including myself. I think that this movement that has grown so much over the last year has the potential to be one of the great moral movements of the last century. You know, it has some of the same features that I think you could see in the anti-Vietnam War movement or the movement, the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. There was a basic sense that the United States government was using its money, and in this case, its weaponry, to do things that fundamentally violate norms of freedom and human dignity. And that while some of the people in that movement have a particular personal or familial ancestral relationship to that place, some of them Palestinian or other people from the Middle East, significant number of them also Jews who have their own personal connection, that what gives the movement its potential power is the fact that there's a moral impetus that does not require any personal connection. Just as like one didn't have to have any personal connection to the people of Vietnam, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, one of my heroes, said that in 1967 that he could not, Rabbi Heschel, who was came from a Polish Hasidic family, he literally could culturally and geographically not have been further away from Vietnam than you could imagine. And yet he said in 1967 that he could not open a siddur, he could not open a prayer book without seeing the images of children being napalmed from American weapons. And I think this movement has that capacity to bring people from every possible different background, especially people who in their own families and experiences have a history of oppression and of their dignity and humanity not respected, but not even only them as well, right? And I think that's extremely powerful.
The protests in and of themselves, they have garnered so much backlash,
yes.
even congressional hearings,
yes.
that
yes.
resulted in the resignation, yes. of two major,
yes.
Presidents of major universities. The universities framed these protests as anti-Semitic,
right,
you
right.
know, and they used extreme measures,
right.
as they brought in riot,
right.
Police and so on and
right.
so forth. How, in your view, have definitions of constitutionality, guaranteed free speech, been redrawn by academia and higher education?
Yeah.
And what has been the impact of the Palestinian exception?
I think we don't fully yet know what the impact will be. We're going to see now that the repression and the silencing that happened by universities and with the encouragement of politicians that was allowed under the Biden administration will now dramatically increase under the Trump administration, and many Democrats will not actually have the moral standing to really oppose it, right? Because they were complicit in it when Democrats were in power. And I also think that, you know, if you look at the anti-BDS legislation, right, legislation to basically say, if you support boycotting Israel, you can't be a contractor for state government, right? There was this woman in Texas who was a special education teacher. She was not allowed to work in the Texas public schools. That then became a template for other groups. So fossil fuel companies decided, oh, this is great, right? We can now also say that if you're going to boycott ExxonMobil, you shouldn't be able to teach in the Texas public schools as well. The Palestine exception, of course, is wrong in and of itself. It's also dangerous because it becomes a model for something else. So if you say that pro-Palestinian protesters can't protest in front of the president's office because it's too disruptive for students and other people who want to work. But once you've set that idea that basically you can't be too disruptive, you can't make too much noise, you can't have more than 25 people or whatever, then lots of people will then use that exception to broaden it to repress speech as well. And, you know, the irony, of course, is that there was a period of time when it was people on the right who were fashioning themselves as the great proponents of free speech, especially on campus. They were saying, don't be snowflakes. The whole point of going to university is that it's supposed to be intellectually, you know, rough and tumble, and you're going to hear things that are challenging to you, but that's good. That's what education is about. And you know what? I think they were right. I think part of going to a university is you're raised with certain views, certain beliefs, and those are challenged. And ideally, they're challenged in a polite and decent and civil way. Sometimes people are jerks about it. Sometimes people challenge them are not particularly nice about it. But as long as they're not physically threatening you, you know, intimidating you or endangering your safety, you should see this as an opportunity to learn. Even if you don't necessarily agree, you're exposed to different points of view than the ones you were raised with. And that's the whole point of going away to university. It's so sad to me that people who could see that and make that argument, sometimes eloquently, when it came to other groups, that when it came to us, to the Jewish community, then all of a sudden the kind of rules change, and that basically then you have this unwillingness to make any distinction between lack of safety and lack of comfort. That Jewish students have an absolute right to be safe on, include Zionist Jewish students have an absolute right to be safe on campus, but no student has the right on campus to be made intellectually comfortable. To be made intellectually uncomfortable, morally uncomfortable, is the point of a university. And if a university tries to stop that from happening, then I think it's violating its own mission.
The incoming Trump administration, their strategy to suppress Palestinian solidarity movement is clear. Weaponizing Islamophobia and accusations of anti-Semitism to silence criticism of U.S. support of the Israeli state and create a chilling impact on potential future activism. Trump would not hesitate to deploy the military, and he regularly spoke about the enemy from within. So with Republicans having a majority control of the House as well as the presidency and the Senate and the courts, are we likely to see an intensification of the student protests, more silencing of Palestinian voices, more crackdown, so on and so forth?
Yes.
Is it going to make our resistance and organizing harder?
I think it will. Yes, absolutely. You know, to me, there's a very painful irony in the fact that this is being done, so much of it is being done in the name of Jewish safety. And sometimes I feel like some of these people who are speaking in the name of Jewish safety, you know, Elise Stefanik or whatever, they're putting Jews forward, right? Because what they really can't say is that they dislike these movements on campus because they feel like they threaten white people. Because that's harder to say. They say that they threaten Jews, right? But the reality is that actually the politics of Elise Stefanik and Donald Trump and Matt Gaetz and all these people are much more dangerous to Jews than a kind of pro-Palestinian protest movement. Again, which is not to say I agree with every single slogan or statement that is made. There's some that I disagree with. But the basic question is that American Jews and Jews in most diaspora societies, we have really staked our safety and the safety of our children on the principle of equality under the law. Right? I mean, obviously, we live in societies that are profoundly unequal. But we have recognized, most of us, that as a group that has historically been singled out for discrimination, that the principle of equality under the law, the principle that Jews in Europe yearned for, and for the most part were never able to achieve in the 19th and then the first half of the 20th century, is the best bet for a group of people like Jews to be safe. And that the closer America moves to that, right, that's why many Jews, not all, but many Jews saw in a kind of enlightened self-interest, the reason that civil rights movement was in their interest, because they saw that since Black Americans were kind of the other in America par excellence, if they moved towards equality under the law, then Jews would benefit enormously from that larger cultural shift and ideology, which they did massively. It was in that period in the 60s that the law firms and country clubs that used to exclude Jews and even universities, have to quote, it's got rid of those things, right? And now you have this terrible irony that you have an Israeli government in partnership with kind of establishment Jewish organizations, where essentially, whether they're admitting it or not, are basically in support of an ethno-nationalist project, a support of white Christian supremacy, or maybe they would call it white Judeo-Christian supremacy, which is just a way of saying it, not for the Muslims, because it's those people who are fervently supportive of Israel. And it's not surprising that those people like Stefanik and Gaetz and those people are fervently supportive of Israel, because they see Israel's ethno-nationalism as a model for the ethno-nationalism they see in the United States. Their vision of the world is that every country should be dominated by one tribe, right? And it's also the vision that Narendra Modi has in India as well, or Viktor Orban has in Hungary, right? And I think that's very dangerous even for the Jews in Israel. I think it's terribly dangerous for Jews in Israel, but it's certainly dangerous for Jews around the world, because if one thing is clear, if every country is dominated by one tribe, our tribe is not going to be the one that's dominating the United States, right? We are a small minority here, quite visible, and the people who demonize other vulnerable groups in the United States, right, very frequently get around to Jews sooner or later, right? The idea that you're going to make a separate peace with white Christian supremacists and you're going to say, great, go after the Muslims, go after the Mexicans, go after the LGBT folks, you like us, right? That generally does not work out very well. The polling shows pretty clearly that one of the best indicators of whether someone doesn't like Jews is whether they don't like immigrants, they don't like trans people, they don't like Muslims. The Pittsburgh shooter did not start out being obsessed with Jews. He got obsessed with these immigrant caravans that were supposedly invading America from Central America. And then he noticed that the synagogue down the road was partnering with a Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society to do a refugee Shabbat, and he decided that Soros was behind the whole thing, and then he ended up committing an act of mass murder against the synagogue, right? So this is how this white Christian supremacism works. And the fact that you have Jewish organizations that are essentially supporting this effort and supporting people who want to move America in an ethno-nationalist direction is not just morally wrong, it's extremely dangerous for us.
Zionism is a settler colonial ideology of Jewish supremacy that privileges one people over another. A decade or so ago, you didn't have a problem with that. And what I'd like to know is what caused this conversion, this transformation? Did you go to the West Bank? Did you meet Palestinian friends? Did you read Ilan Pape, Edward Said, Shlomo Sand, Avi Schleim, Rashid Khalidi, and any of the others? Yeah. What happened there?
Well, I'll tell you my views as they are now. My views have, as you know, have changed, and so they could change again. I think that the first thing that's worth acknowledging is that Zionism before the creation of Israel as a Jewish state had more variety and more fluidity than it did once Israel was created. So there were people who, Noam Chomsky at one point was part of a Zionist youth movement. He was as a very young man in a Zionist movement, which passionately opposed the creation of a Jewish state. Right? Martin Buber defined himself as a cultural Zionist. He testified against partition and against the creation of a Jewish state. Right? So Zionism at a certain point meant something broader. There were Zionists who believed in the importance of a Jewish thriving culture in Palestine, but opposed a Jewish state. That Zionism, of course, was never the dominant Zionism, and it's not the Zionism that Israel has been enacting since 1948. But in some ways, I think that lost cultural Zionism, which believed in a binational state, which was where Said ended up his life after giving up on the idea of two states, is an important thing to remember, especially for Jews. And it's the reason I think it's important to remember that there were those figures is so much often in the mainstream Jewish conversation, the assumption is if you oppose a Jewish state, a state that privileges Jews over Palestinians, it means that you don't believe that Jews should be allowed to live in this territory. Or your view is that essentially it's just taken for granted that it would be impossible for Jews to live and thrive in this territory unless they had a state in which they had legal supremacy. And I think it's important to recognize that there is a tradition of Jewish thinking, even of people who called themselves Zionists, who fundamentally rejected that and who actually believed that Jewish culture in that land would be much more successful over the long term if it was not linked to a state project that oppressed Palestinians. I think that you are right. I agree with you that Zionism is a settler colonial movement that has disenfranchised and destroyed Palestinian society and continues to do that to this day in horrifying ways. I also think that Zionism, even state Zionism, is not only that. I think it also led to the creation of a state that gave people coming out of the Holocaust a refuge and even an experience of liberation. And I don't think those two things are in conflict. Right? I mean, if one thinks about, it's a different historical example, but if one thinks about another settler colonial project, the settler colonial project of Liberia, for instance. Liberia was a state founded by enslaved Black Americans who returned to West Africa and would have seen Liberia as a kind of refuge. It was also a settler colonial project that brutally dispossessed the native people in West Africa, right? And this is why when people say Zionism can't be settler colonialism because Jews have deep roots in what we call Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, right? It clearly can, right? The people of Liberia who set up a settler colonial project in Liberia had very deep roots, in fact, had been in West Africa much more recently. They still enacted a settler colonial project, talking about modernity, modernization, talking about progress, practicing dispossession, which is what settler colonial movements do. My own views evolved, I would say, primarily more than anything else in response to spending time in the West Bank with Palestinians. It took me way too long in my life. It was not really until my early 30s, even though I had been to Israel, like many, you know, many Jews had as a kid many times, I had had very little interaction with Palestinians. And my understanding of Israel was very much, I think, cloistered and limited by not being able to, as Said famously said, see Zionism from the standpoint of its victims. I tended to think about it primarily through this, from the standpoint of people like my grandmother, who was born in Egypt, who then lived in the Belgian Congo, then lived in South Africa, and always felt to her, given the precarity of her life, that a Jewish state provided her with a sense of safety and security. And I knew that Israel was doing things that were not good. But the problem is that knowing that something is happening that's not good in a vague, abstract way doesn't really touch your heart. You need to be able to associate it with actual people who you see, who you meet, who you talk to, and to see what happens to them. And so when I first began to do that, I knew that it was going to be the beginning of a process. I didn't know where it would lead ultimately. I didn't know it would ultimately lead here. But I knew it was going to be a process in which I was going to have to rethink a lot of things. And initially, I thought, again, it was also the times I thought, well, a partition between a Jewish and Palestinian state would be the most practical response to this fundamental problem. Palestinians won't have an occupying army in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem anymore. But over time, it became clear to me, first of all, clear to other people long before me, but eventually to me as well, that partition was not possible. And also that partition didn't answer some more fundamental questions, which is to say, if the point of partition is to maintain a Jewish state, well, then partition cannot allow for Palestinian refugee return because that imperils Israel's demographic majority. And as I began to think about it, it just didn't seem to me that I had any moral rationale for arguing that people who were born in Safed or in Haifa or in Jaffa or in Lod or wherever and had been expelled or didn't have the right to return. And then people would say, often I heard people will say, yeah, but those, their children or grandchildren are not original refugees. They weren't born in those places themselves. And I would think, wait a second, we're the group of people who said we have the right to return after 2,000 years to a place that most of us have never lived. So we are the last people on earth who should be telling people that they have to give up on the right to return to a place because it was 75 years is nothing, right? I mean, if anyone has experienced Tisha B'Av in the Jewish calendar, right? We're talking about things that happened 2,000 years, and we talk about it in the first person. So again, it just didn't make any sense to me. And so then I just became impossible to reconcile this idea of a Jewish state, a state that privileges Jews, with the idea that Palestinians have a right to return and that Palestinian citizens have the right to be treated equally, which you can't be treated equally in a state that gives legal privileges to people of another, ethno-religious group any more than I could be treated equally in America if it was a Christian state. And so that's what ultimately led me to the position I have now, which is I believe in an equal binational state.
Your grandmother means a lot to you. And you dedicate the new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, you dedicate it to her memory. In your dedication, you say that she disagreed with arguments in this book. You also start your book with a note to my former friend, who believes that your opposition to the war on Gaza constitutes a betrayal of your people. How do you talk to your grandmother, your family members, your friends, and those who can't see the injustice of apartheid, ethnic cleansing, oppression, dehumanization, so on and so forth? How do you convince them that this is not the path to Jewish safety?
Well, I mean, I wrote the book precisely because I was so struggling so much with that. I mean, with my grandmother's memory, but also with so many people around me who are very, very important to me, very precious to me, who in so many other ways in which they aspects of their lives I respect and admire so deeply. You know, it's one thing when you see someone who you think, this is not such a great person. They're not a thoughtful person. They're kind of crude. So they don't care about the destruction of an entire society in Gaza, that most of the universities are destroyed, most of the hospitals are destroyed, most of the agriculture is destroyed, most of the buildings are destroyed, because that's the kind of person they are. They just have no human sensitivity. They don't go through life that way. But I'm thinking about people who are not that way at all, people who in other aspects of their lives are very, very thoughtful, very, very decent, very conscious of the way they are in the world. And for me, the most, and in a way, my grandmother, although she was not an intellectual, you know, she was someone who had like very deep generosity of spirit and empathy for people and deep love, deep, deep love of the Jewish people, deep sense of this idea that that she thought of Jews as an extended family and that who was obligated to one another. And yet I really struggled, especially over the last year, with the way in which this sense of solidarity, this language of solidarity and mutual obligation, which I really believe in, then gets turned through a nationalist or ethno-nationalist project into gets weaponized in ways that are extremely, extremely dangerous and can allow even really good and decent, thoughtful people to basically just shut down and deploy a series of what seem to me really transparent talking points in order to not have to experience and feel and respond to what's being done in their and in our name.
You're listening to Peter Beinert on Protest, Zionism, and Gaza. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
My book was kind of an effort to try to speak to those people and to say, listen, we're losing something of ourselves in this. We're not only endangering Palestinians, but we're also very much, I think, endangering Israeli and other Jews, because I believe that ultimately the safety of Israeli Jews and the safety of Palestinians is intimately interconnected. It is just utterly foolish, it seems to me, to believe that you can inflict terrible, terrible, catastrophic violence on people again and again and again and not be endangering yourselves. To me, that is one of the lessons of October 7th. That is not to justify October 7th. It's simply to say that the way you act to others is also likely to influence the way other people act to you. It's the most basic of human realities. And part of what my book tries to do in one of the chapters is to look at the way in which Israel has responded when Palestinians have fought for their freedom in ways that do not take Israeli civilian life. How have Israel and the United States government and an organized American Jewish community responded when Palestinians have gone to international institutions like the UN and the International Criminal Court, when they've launched boycotts, when they marched nonviolently in 2018 to the borders, to the fence of Gaza? How do they even respond when the Palestinian Authority adopted a strategy of appeasement, of essentially of a kind of collaboration? I mean, it's an astonishing thing that the PA did, right? I mean, it basically said, we're going to work with the Israeli government to make sure that there is not violent resistance in the West Bank in the hopes that you will then trust us enough to have a state. Even that, basically, they got nothing for. And so in those conditions, those actions of shutting down that kind of resistance make it more likely you're going to get the kind of resistance that you got on October 7th.
It was one of the main reasons why Hamas was elected in 2006 is exactly because of that. Because the Palestinian people did not see any benefits.
I mean, there were people like Saeed who saw that Oslo, from the beginning, he saw Oslo is a trap, it's a Palestinian Versailles. But the polling data that I looked at showed that there was a period of time in the beginning of Oslo in which there was a lot of optimism about Oslo among Palestinians, and there was support, and that was the point in which support for violent resistance was at its lowest, but certainly by Netanyahu's election it is completely cratered, because you see that settlement growth is continuing, and this creates the opportunity for people to say, Your strategy is not working. I had a Palestinian friend from Gaza who has told me about conversations he had with people he grew up with who were in Hamas. And he said, they said to me again and again, how well have your efforts worked? You know, have you gotten anything for us?
You quote Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, yes. And he said about Judaism is about the universality of justice. In your view, do you think Judaism has been hijacked by Zionism? And without Judaism, Zionism would not be able to survive?
Zionism has always had a strange relationship with Judaism in the sense that it was in some ways a rebellion against Judaism, because the kind of normative understanding of Jewish law was that God had decided to exile the Jewish people from the land of Israel. And when God decided to bring a Messiah and transform the world and bring the Jews back. God would do it in God's time. And the role of Jews until that happened was to live in the societies in which they lived, do the best they can, follow Jewish law, and pray to God. Zionism was a rebellion against that. And the reason that overwhelmingly Jewish religious authorities were initially opposed to Zionism was because it was a movement led by secular people that was a rebellion against Jewish law. But it was also essentially politicizing this religious idea of the connection to the land of Israel. And this is why when Herzl, who thought that maybe they could try to start a Jewish state somewhere else, right? Basically, he found that the masses of Orthodox Jews in Eastern Europe could only become political Zionists if it was going to connect to their religious association with the land of Israel that they had been steeped in their entire lives. To me, I think that the problem is that Judaism, like all other religions, has many voices and many messages. It's dangerous to try to essentialize it in any way. But there is the notion that human beings are created in the image of God. And so nothing should be elevated above human beings who are considered to have of infinite value. And it seems to me what Zionism has done, what the State of Israel has done, it is that it has led many people in the organized American Jewish community to elevate this state above the absolute value of the human beings who live within this state, more than half of whom are Palestinian, who are also created in the image of God, right? And so that, to me, is an act of idolatry because, Heschel said that there's only one thing that's created in the image of God, is the human being. And to act as if anything else is sacred or sacrosanct is to turn it into an idol and to be practicing idolatry, right? And you see this in this phrase, does Israel have a right to exist? I think the answer, this is something that Yeshayahu Leibovitz, the Israeli philosopher, said, absolutely not. No state has a right to exist. Human beings have rights. States are just instruments. They are instruments for the protection of human life and human flourishing and human dignity. And their legitimacy is entirely based on how good a job they do in protecting the rights and dignity of life of the people. And so when you use the phrase, does Israel have a right to exist, as a way to shut down a conversation about what Israel is doing in slaughtering all of these people, right? You are elevating the state above the human being. And I think this is what Leibovitz and Heschel and others saw as idolatry. And I wonder whether there is a parallel to some degree to what's happening among some white Christians in the United States vis-a-vis Trump in the United States, which is that all of a sudden these people for whom they believe that Christianity is central, right? I'm not an expert on Christianity, but my understanding is that Christianity also has a universal principle about human dignity, regardless of what nation you live in, where you happen to be born, about human dignity, right? But what's happened is this nationalist, ethno-nationalist enterprise means that essentially your notion of Trump and of kind of American nationhood just completely leads you to not care about the human lives that you're going to destroy when you try to start rounding up millions of people in January. And to me, that's analogous to what I see, unfortunately, in certain areas of the Jewish community when we talk about what's happening in Gaza.
As Israel becomes more and more an international symbol of oppression, racism, genocide, isn't this in of itself putting Jews around the world in greater danger?
Yes. Now, to say yes is not to absolve people of their moral responsibility. If you take out your anger against Israel because of the terrible, terrible things that Israel's doing, and you go and you harass or beat up a Jewish person, that doesn't mean that if you take out your hostility towards Israel against a Jewish person, that you are absolved of responsibility. You're not absolved of responsibility. You have a responsibility to make a distinction between your opposition to that state and your opposition to that individual person, just like you have a responsibility, no matter how you feel about the People's Republic of China, not to take out your animosity towards the People's Republic of China on a Chinese-American person, right? But the problem, it seems to me, that we have in fighting against people who conflate Israel and Jews and therefore take out their anger against Israel on Jews is that we're trying to ask them to make a distinction between Israel as a state and Jews as a group of people. But the organized American Jewish community is not making that distinction ourselves so often. So you find that the Jewish organizations are often saying something along the lines of that being a Zionist or supporting Israel is inherent in being Jewish. First of all, just that statement really doesn't make any sense, because Judaism existed for a long time before Zionism existed, and there have always been significant numbers of Jews, right, for a variety of reasons, who opposed political Zionism in the State of Israel. But it's also just very dangerous because you are making exactly the conflation that we want people who oppose Israel and Zionism not to make. So when the chief rabbi of Israel, of the United Kingdom said a few years ago, he said that Zionism leaps from every page of the Siddur, of the Jewish prayer book. It's a very strange statement given that we've had prayer books since long, long before, you know, Herzl and Pinsker came along in the late 19th century. Then why shouldn't someone write Free Palestine on a Jewish prayer book? You've basically just said it's the equivalent of basically of a political pamphlet for the State of Israel, right? And that's a very, very dangerous thing to do. Look, most of the anti-Semitism that endangers Jews is coming from the ethno-nationalist right. We have data that shows that there's literally data in Belgium, Australia, and the United States, three studies that show in a given week, if Israel kills more Palestinians, there's a rise of reported anti-Semitic incidents, right? So we do see that this does happen, and it seems to me fighting it requires everyone to agree that the State of Israel is one thing and that Jews are another thing, just like Saudi Arabia is one thing and Muslim people in the United States are another thing, right? Or that the People's Republic of China is one thing and Chinese Americans is another thing. But both sides have to do that work. You're not going to be effective in asking anti-Zionists to do that work if you don't affirm that principle yourself.
The narrative that's forged by the political elites and mainstream media sets clear parameters on what is deemed acceptable and what is not. The narrative that prevails today is that Israel is a Western-style democracy that has the right to defend itself. Can you describe to us how dehumanization is being used as a tool of genocide? And what can we do to help shift that narrative on Israel-Palestine?
You know, I've often tried to imagine over the last year what it would be like to be Palestinian, especially Palestinian people who have family in Gaza. And my mind almost like goes blank, even though, of course, this is different in many ways from the Shoah, from the Holocaust. Jews, I think, will naturally, when we try to think about the worst thing we can possibly imagine, our minds will naturally go to that. And like many people, grew up with many people who were the children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. So I always think about what I saw in those families and the trauma in those families and the way it reverberated from generation to generation. But then I remember that I'm seeing those people, the Holocaust had ended, and they were in a completely different place, right, where they had much greater safety, right? I was seeing them in the United States or in South Africa or Australia or something. So the event had ended. They were far away in a country there where they were not being brutally oppressed. And the world had acknowledged what had happened. And so they were still deeply traumatized. But those conditions allowed the beginnings of some healing. And yet those conditions just don't exist for Palestinians at all, right? There's no, it's ongoing. There's no other place you can go to for most people. And it's not recognized. It's essentially saying, well, what did you do to bring this upon yourself? This dehumanization is so deep that we don't even have a language. We talk frequently about anti-Semitism, but we don't even have a word or a language to talk about bigotry against Palestinians. And I think the reason we don't is because it's so omnipresent that if you had a word for it, it would include almost everybody in Congress, right? Rashida Tlaib would be one of the relatively small numbers of members of Congress who is not an anti-Palestinian bigot, because she's one of the very few who believes that Palestinians and Israeli Jews deserve equality. That's a tiny, tiny percentage of even the Democrats who take that position. It's a very small percentage of the people in mainstream media who take that position, right? It's simply assumed that Palestinians are lesser and deserve less than Israeli Jews. It's so assumed that it's not even, you don't need to articulate that position. And that, I think, is what has laid the foundation, right? And, you know, this decades and decades of what Said said, the lack of permission to narrate, you know, the work that Maha Nasser has done just about how rare it is to have Palestinians being represented in mainstream publications. I think that The possibilities of the change are because of the way that Palestinians and others who are sympathetic to Palestinians organized on social media and in other places to create alternative voices. I think that's part of the reason you see this generational divide, is because younger people are just getting their media in very different ways. And so they are getting their media in a media that has the potential to be more democratized. But the shift of that media, of that into the mainstream media, is very, very, very slow, and in some ways was set back by October 7th. And we're seeing the consequences of this. I mean, I think this is what Ta-Nehisi Coates' book is about in a lot of ways. It's about the interrelationship between a story in which you were written out of a story and the way in which then your life becomes disposable.
I'd like to speak about, to talk about the Trump administration that's coming in January.
If we have to.
Yes. So in the past, American politicians used to say, no politician ever lost an election by being too pro-Israel. In your recent New York Times article, it was called Democrats Ignored Gaza and Brought Down Their Party. You argue that the 2024 election proved the contrary. That you said in this new era in which supporting Palestinian freedom has become central to what it means to be progressive, the Palestinian exception is not just immoral, it is politically disastrous. Do you think that the Democratic Party leadership will ever conclude that they're continuing to support ethnic cleansing, racism, apartheid, and genocide is not in their self-interest?
I think there's a possibility that that could happen. First of all, I should say that obviously I don't believe that Kamala Harris lost only because of Gaza. There were many factors. Many of them are just kind of mundane and have been discussed a lot. Inflation has been a politically disastrous for governments all around the world in the wake of COVID. But I do think it's hard to explain how poorly she did among young voters in particular, how much more poorly she did than Joe Biden, despite the fact that, you know, evidently her TikTok game was very good. And actually, she did surprisingly well among older and white voters. That's not where she saw the drop-off. There you see, because it's obviously younger voters who had a much, much more sympathy for Palestinians than older voters. The Democratic Party's challenge is that American politics is very deeply corrupt. And there's a deep corruption in the way we fund our campaigns. And so if you're the kind of Democrat, and Joe Biden was this kind of Democrat par excellence, who can only fund their campaign by going to very big donors, those donors are going to push you in a position, a place on Israel, but not just on Israel, also on regulation of Wall Street, regulation of fossil fuels, healthcare, you know, all of these things that is going to lead you to be out of touch, that's going to lead you to not inspire the Democratic Party base. And it's also actually going to leave you vulnerable to the fake populism of Trump and the right, in which people will use this anti-corporate rhetoric on the right. But there's an opportunity there because the Democrats have squandered that. And Trump even used it a little bit on Gaza and Lebanon, basically saying, I'm going to end these wars with some success.
So, and a lot of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans went for it. And now they're saying, we've been played.
Right. What a shocker. Donald Trump lied. But I think if you have a Democratic candidate who can excite people, who can build a movement in different ways, Barack Obama did that and Bernie Sanders did that. That person can raise enough money through small donations by exciting people that they won't need to be so reliant on large donors. And that can give them the freedom to say things on Palestinian freedom, but also on a whole range of issues that are much, much more popular and that I think could potentially really excite younger voters, excite other voters who are alienated from the Democrats, and even win back some of those voters who have drifted into the Republican column. So the key thing to me, it seems to me, is what kind of campaign and candidate you have and who is funding it.
For more than a year now, we have seen that Joe Biden has not wavered in his material support as Israel conducts its genocide. We can expect that support to continue under the Trump administration. Since October 7th, Trump has urged Prime Minister Netanyahu to finish the job, so-called. He said, do what you have to do. On the campaign trail, Trump said, we're going to do a lot for Israel. And when Trump won, his friend Netanyahu said he is the best friend that Israel has ever had in the White House. This Trump finished the job comment, do you think that ethnic cleansing is part of that job? And will this increase the instability in the region? Do you think that Trump in office will speed up Israel's endgame of what I have been calling the out-of-state solution, not the two-state or one-state, emptying Gaza of Palestinians and continuing its ethnic cleansing? And
yes. We know from reporting that Netanyahu was urging Western leaders to try to pressure the Egypt in the early days of the war to open the borders, right? So there would be a mass exodus of Palestinians. And obviously, there's no reason whatsoever to believe they ever would be allowed to return. We know that that's what, you know, Israeli people in the Israeli government were talking about that. The Egypt held the line and refused this. But I think it's completely plausible to imagine that the Trump administration, maybe even with the support of some in the Gulf, who have a lot of leverage over Egypt because it's very much in debt and relies a lot on the Gulf countries, will renew that effort and push very hard. And so, yes, to me, when I think about Israeli strategy and what happened on October 7th, there was no mainstream political leadership in Israel that supported Palestinians having their own state. That position doesn't exist in mainstream Israeli politics. Obviously, there's no mainstream Israeli view that says that Palestinians should have equality alongside Israeli Jews in one state. The mainstream position, the moderate position, like Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz, was Palestinians are going to live under brutal oppression, and we're going to manage that oppression through a process of carrots and sticks, right? If maybe they'll get a little few more permits to travel across if there's no violence, and if there is, we'll come down on them very hard. Bezalel Smotrich and the people on the Israeli right had a different view. They said, you can't manage this situation. We're not going to give them their own country. We're not going to give them equality. But we can't manage this oppression because they are going to resist. And if they resist, we're going to have to basically force them out. So that was, you know, Smotrich wrote this thing called the Decisive Plan in 2017. He said, basically, if Palestinians don't accept their subjugation, they have to leave, essentially, right? And what October 7th showed was that the management process does not work. You can't do it. You can't manage millions of people who you deny the most basic human rights to. And that is why I think the Smotrich position has moved towards center stage. That idea that basically you're going to solve the Palestinian problem, you could call this the American solution, right? How did America solve these problems in the 19th century? Did we divide the country along the Mississippi River in a two-state solution? No, we did not. It took generations, but ultimately we so destroyed the native population that they were not a political threat. They couldn't act politically anymore. And so, you know, people say, well, you can't do in the 21st century what you did in the 19th century. We don't know that. Is that the case? That in some ways is the macro question. Can you or not, in a world of Donald Trump and Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin and climate change, and the norms that restrain states are not growing stronger. They're growing weaker. And that seems to me the question for the entire planet, in some ways, that is on the line here. Because if you can do it to Palestinians, I think you can do it. There are many other leaders around the world. I'm sure Narendra Modi is looking at what Benjamin Netanyahu is doing. Gosh, that was like, we have a lot of Muslims in India. Maybe that we could solve our problem with Muslims in India this way too, and many, many other places. It would be bad enough if it were just happening to Palestinians and it didn't have any of the repercussions. But the truth is the repercussions, I think, for the entire world of this being able to actually be accomplished, which it could be accomplished, are just catastrophic.
I'd like to, in the last few minutes, talk about the Trump's cabinet lineup, which includes Marco Rubio as Secretary of State and Elise Stefanik as the ambassador to the United Nations.
Yeah. And they're not sending us their best.
And Mike Huckabee, my God, ambassador to Israel.
Yeah.
This morning, actually, in an article in the Haaretz, Israeli journalist Gideon Levy said, this should not be labeled friends of Israel. They should be labeled as the worst of its enemies. Mm-hmm. The new people in charge of the U.S.'s foreign policy are friends of apartheid, occupation, the settlements, and war. These are president-shifting appointments spell more doom for the region and its people. Based on Trump's appointments, it's becoming clear that the annexation and Greater Israel could be at the forefront of any political agenda. A river to sea, Israel is on Trump's horizon. And reinforcing that is Netanyahu's appointment of none other than Kahanist Yeshil Leiter as the new Israeli ambassador to Israel.
Yeah.
So these disgusting appointments are, I want to say a slap in the face, but it's more like a giant middle finger to the rule of international human rights. And wouldn't you agree?
Yes, absolutely. This fanatical support for Israel that you see in the Trump administration is not it's not coincidental. Israel is not, in a lot of ways, the way Israel functions in American politics is not really as a foreign country exactly. It's more like a proxy debate about the nature of the United States, because Israel is, for many people in the Republican Party, and not only the Republican Party, you see for people in Europe too, right? And for people in India, the shining model for them of a high-tech, economically dynamic, supremacist, ethno-nationalist political system, which is what they want in their own country. So in a way, the way they're responding to Israel is they want to support Israel as part of their effort to make America more like that. What does Trump want? Trump wants an America that kind of has clear legal hierarchies between people of different racial, religious, ethnic groups. He wants an immigration policy that maintains our demographic majority. All of these things. But I think this is also why the pro-Israel position in the Democratic Party, or what was, you know, historically often been called the progressive except Palestine position, why it's weakening and even potentially crumbling. Because Mike Huckabee is a very bad spokesperson if you're trying to maintain support for Israel inside a Democratic Party, because his vision of America is so fundamentally antithetical. And I think more progressive-minded people in the United States also understand that because that the people who in America who are most supportive of Israel are also the people who are trying to turn America into a country based on legal supremacy in a struggle that is really an existential struggle for us here in the United States. And that's why I think we're seeing this gradual, clear alignment. Basically, there are people who support ethno-nationalism here and there, and there are people who oppose ethno-nationalism here and there. And I think that's where the hope is, that maybe people who oppose it here and there ultimately will be able to gain the upper hand in the Democratic Party.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You were just listening to Peter Beinart on protests, Zionism, and Gaza. He spoke at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in mid-November. Peter Beinart is professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York. He's a contributing opinion writer at the New York Times and editor-at-large of Jewish Currents. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Francesca Albanese, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Peter Beinart on Protest, Zionism, and Gaza, and for Rashid Khaledi's book, The 100 Years' War on Palestine, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Sut Jolly of the Media Education Foundation and to Michelle Moshebek of Olive Branch Books. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Shive of Ireland. She's singing Rifat al-Arir's poem, If I Must Die. Rifat al-Arir was a noted Palestinian writer, poet, and professor. He was killed by Israel in Gaza on December 6, 2023.
Heaven.